I know you have some new and exciting things going on, but I would love to give people a little bit of background on you. And if we could step back for just a minute, you are very famous for founding a certain type of culinary movement called the New Nordic Cuisine Movement. What is this?
So the New Nordic Cuisine Movement was a virus. It became a virus, but it was the simple idea to see if we could create an informal collaboration amongst a vast array of people and institutions in order to transform the food culture. We wanted to see if the Nordic food culture could become one of the greatest and most delicious and most admirable ones in the world, and what it would take to get there, and which value you should lean on the journey to get it right. That was kind of the substance of the project.
Okay, what does it embody? What is the?
Yeah, so on the one hand, it's an aesthetic expression. Okay. It's the food on the plate. The flavor, the texture, the colors, the underlying techniques of the food. So it's an expression on the plate. And speaking about the food component of it, it is a cooking style that is, compared to modern American food or classical French food, much lighter, brighter, vegetable-oriented, juicy, fresh, vibrant, and aromatic, and light. And at the same time, it's also a changed paradigm. So the wording of the Nordic Cuisine Manifesto, that is the ideology, the guiding light to everyone, was very much about sustainability, healthiness, biodiversity, terroir, the connectivity to the space, mm-hmm. Inclusion, that an openness, so some ethical rules about the collaboration itself. But very much, should I say it very briefly, I would call it hedonistic sustainability or sustainable hedonism, the idea of bridging joy with responsibility towards nature and the next generations.
Okay. Now, a few things you just said there, vegetable focus, sustainable. These are things that we're seeing more and more of today. Did this really kind of start that, get that ball rolling? Did it lay the groundwork?
Somehow, I mean, also the whole role of the chef as a social role model, standing up for things that is larger than the accolades towards his restaurant or Michelin stars, it kind of started there.
Okay.
Until then, everybody were obsessed with their position in the Michelin Guide or something. But since 2003, chefs started launching philanthropic initiatives and having purpose-driven restaurants, and that really wasn't a normal. Of course, I can find a couple of American restaurants. I mean, Addis Waters is one of the few examples who, prior to 2003, had a purpose.
Well, one place where this new Nordic cuisine movement was very famously applied is Noma in Copenhagen, which was the world's best restaurant for several years. What made it such a success? I mean, what drew people to this style of cuisine and of eating?
Yeah, there was a phenomenal synergy between Noma and the Nordic cuisine movement. I did not start Noma with René to create the best restaurant in the world, but to do our part. We wanted to explore the potential of local produce. So we basically lived in that restaurant the values of the Nordic Cuisine Movement or the Nordic Cuisine Manifesto. And what made it great, I think timing was right at that time when we launched our project. The whole world of foodies and food journalism was looking for a new story. They've been writing about the Spanish cuisine for the last 6 years, and everybody was fed up with Ferran Adrià and El Bulli, and because you've been reading about that for so many years, and the French cuisine was stagnating. So the world was looking for the next story. And also, there was a discrepancy between the zeitgeist in the modern world, people's anxieties about the global resource problem, the ridiculous thing that, you know, more than a billion people are suffering from hunger and another billion people are suffering from poverty, and the collapsing food systems in general. And this was in no way reflected in the world of fine dining. So we have a responsibility in fine dining. We have to reflect what's important in the world. So this discrepancy made our take on cooking extremely interesting for people with a high consciousness about what's involved in our food. And I think and then you can't. We actually managed to create a fantastic team in the restaurant, and René was leading his brigade with a lot of smartness, and the food actually itself was pretty stunning.
And now you've taken that food philosophy out of Denmark, and you started an organization called the Melting Pot Foundation, where you've brought this sense of food activism and social change through food to places all over the world. Can you talk a little bit about that organization and what you've been doing?
So basically, after 5 years, Noma was voted best in the world for the first time. I saw a lot of Nordic institutions, governmental bodies, tourism organizations, big food companies trying to take the idea as a hostage to build their own short-term profits and individual gains. And I thought that this was wrong. I thought there should be more to it. I hope that there was more to the idea than just benefiting an affluent region. And then a very smart old man called me up, a man called Jan, who helped me write the manifesto. And he said, Klaus, I've read the manifesto once more, and I found something very interesting. I believe we can leave out the word Nordic. And that gave me goosebumps all over my whole body. I said, what do you mean you can leave out the word Nordic? Yeah, try read it. Take out, just put in Greece or Albany or something. And then I saw that maybe he was right. So maybe it was not a manifesto for the liberation of our cuisine, but maybe it was a sort of a defense speech for any ethnical or indigenous cuisine all over the world. And then I got that stupid, naive idea that maybe you could test that in a country. You could find a country and test it out. And that was the moment when I decided to start a proper vehicle for that, which became Melting Pot. Melting Pot was formerly to take everything I had learned from starting Noma, the cuisine movement, and 30 years as an entrepreneur, and try to bring that into the hands of struggling people, marginalized people, vulnerable people in prisons, in poor countries. And the first big project was to go to Bolivia and see if we could make another food revolution down there without being kicked out by Evo Morales, who the president of Bolivia, who's not very fond normally of people messing up with his country. So I went down there with $500,000 in my pocket that I could spend. And I found another NGO that would match that money. And then we launched the idea, built another restaurant in La Paz as a social project that was kind of run by, well, in this case, a chef and another chef. So they were basically hiring 60 young Bolivians from the slums of La Paz and training them to cook and wait. And, and then in 2013, we opened the doors for Gusto. And also these two guys were doing a fantastic job, and timing seemed to be right. We onboarded a lot of engaged Bolivians, and now Gusto is voted 14th best restaurant in Latin America, and the female head chef is voted best female head chef of Latin America in 2016, and the project is almost cash flow positive. Then coming to New York to do a restaurant in Manhattan and a big food hall, I just felt that I should do more, and that's where I stumbled across the needs of the community of Brownsville and the people of Brownsville, and decided to see what I could do out there.
Okay, talk about that project there, because it's so much more than, it is a culinary school, but it's so much more than a culinary school. Who are the people that you're really, really targeting, and what types of programs are you offering?
Now that I have my wingman, Lucas Stenson, with me, I'd probably rather have you speak about that, Lucas.
Sure. So in Brownsville, we've created this institution, the Brownsville Community Culinary Center. For the culinary education program, we're recruiting young people from the Brownsville neighborhood in central Brooklyn area from the ages of 18 to 34. We don't have any requirements for application. It's open to all to apply in that age range. And, but we're getting a lot of people who haven't followed it, what many would consider a traditional path. So a lot of our participants don't have high school diplomas or college degrees. Many of our applicants have had experience with the criminal justice system. Many are single parents. So it's people who haven't had as many opportunities to join quote unquote mainstream society as many other people. And that's the story of Brownsville in a nutshell, is just a massive lack of resources, a very kind of purposeful abandonment of the neighborhood by New York City and the country in general. So to speak a little bit about the idea behind the project, we went into Brownsville fully expecting that we wouldn't have a solution for the neighborhood, nor would we have the wherewithal to devise a solution for the neighborhood. We knew up front that the solution would have to come from Brownsville. So we spent a good year doing research and making connections within the community so that they could inform the development of the process and put forth idea after idea, refining the idea so that the Brownsville Community Culinary Center, as it exists now, and well, hopefully when it opens in about a month, will truly reflect the input of the community.
In all these projects that you've mentioned, they're all driving change. What is it about food that can really drive this change and cause social change?
It's a good question. What is it about it? Well, I also set up a couple of food schools in Danish prisons, and that was probably where I learned the most about what the food can actually do. So if you teach people who have been beaten up by their parents or by the system or by their enemies or just have a hard life and tend to be tough people in their lives, if you suddenly teach them to cook a great meal, chop onion, saute them lightly in butter and add a chicken stock and just slowly create a wonderful meal for somebody else. It could be a family member, it could be a child. Then you bring out enormous emotions in them, and suddenly this may seem naive, but this is what I saw, this is what we saw. They suddenly see themselves as giving people, caring people, and they by seeing themselves suddenly giving love and being appreciated by other people around them, something magical happens. Also, just by feeding people, super delicious food, and also teaching them how to make that themselves, this idea of transferring resources into them means something. The whole idea of looking upon somebody who hasn't gotten love from his father or mother in his childhood, looking upon somebody with the eyes of a parent. In his own right. So in this case, food is an excuse for me and him, or me and her, to have a small moment together. And when I, in that conversation, looks upon that person with love, something may happen. And I remember we orchestrated workshops where the prison guardians helped the inmates make a baking workshop for the kids of the inmates. And that was very, very emotional at more levels. So food is, in that way, becomes a vehicle for something much larger than the food itself. And it could maybe have been dance or music instead that could have done the same thing. On top of that, everybody want to believe somehow that you can be something great one day. So when you add to the idea of looking upon somebody with love, the idea of looking upon someone with the eyes of a potential employer, saying, if we make this together, if you work hard in this field for 3 months, 6 months, I could probably find you a job. I think you have a great potential. And if you support that journey, truly, honestly, eyes to eyes, then that means something. It's very basic. There's a job at the end of the road. But there is also the idea of giving love to other people by cooking, and the simple act of enjoying a great meal that you have done, made yourself. So there's a lot into it.